This is the podcast of the Leeds Centre for Dante Studies. Welcome to the fifth of our Conversations on Dante, a series of discussions with researchers whose work is helping to shape our understanding of Dante, his context and works, and his role in the cultures of the world. I'm Matthew Traherne, and today I'm joined by two philosophers of religion, Tasia Scruton and Simon Hewitt. Tasia and Simon are colleagues of mine at the University of Leeds, and they're going to discuss with me today their work relating to theories on grief, and in particular on continuing bonds theory, which explores the ways in which the living experience and cultivate an ongoing relationship with the dead. Tasia and Simon discuss with me the idea of a continuing bond with the dead in C.S. Lewis's diary, A Grief Observed, published in 1961, following the death of his wife. A Grief Observed ends with a quotation from Dante's Paradiso, from Canto 31, when Beatrice looks smilingly to Dante and then returns to her place in the Empyrean. Tasia and Simon take C.S. Lewis's quotation from Dante at this point as an invitation to explore some really interesting questions in Dante, in C.S. Lewis himself, also in Aquinas and Augustine, about this question of the continuing bond between the living and the dead. I think it can prompt us to ask some really important questions, both about how we read Dante and also about some of our modern preconceptions and the way in which Dante can speak to our lives today. I hope you enjoy our conversation. So, Tasia and Simon, we're talking to each other. We're all in Leeds, but we're talking to each other on Skype. So it's really nice to speak to you this morning.
It's brilliant to be here. Yeah, thank you very much for inviting us.
Now, I wonder if we could start just by thinking a bit about continuing bonds theory, what this is, how it relates to theories about grief.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a theory or perhaps an emphasis within grief theory. The term was coined in 1996. It's seen as a move away from what's called the breaking bonds paradigm, where psychologists regarded the goal of bereavement to be breaking bonds with the deceased. So the purpose of the grieving process, if you like, was to cease to be attached to the person who had died so that you could instead form different attachments with other people. And the continuing bonds people said, well, it's not really like that for a lot of people. And they looked at other cultures, at studies in other cultures. For example, there was a very influential study of Japanese widows who practiced ancestor veneration towards their husbands. That sounds odd, but that's how ancestor veneration kind of works. It's not just ancestors in the sense that we use the term. And it turned out that even though they obviously weren't breaking bonds with the deceased, they were continuing bonds with their dead husbands through ancestor veneration, that actually they were at least as psychologically healthy as people in the West who had been encouraged to break bonds, and perhaps they were even more psychologically healthy. So the continuing bonds theorists kind of said, well, look, it's not the case that there's a correlation between breaking bonds and being healthy or continuing bonds and being pathological. So maybe this emphasis isn't quite right. In particular, they pointed to examples where they felt it had been quite inhumane to kind of force people to kind of break bonds. In addition to kind of looking at other cultures, they also pointed to examples of continuing bonds much closer to home. So visiting a person's grave, perhaps talking to someone when you're at their grave, or talking to them on their birthday or whatever, things that perhaps people don't talk about doing as much because there's a degree of embarrassment about it, but a lot of people do a lot of the time. Looking at pictures at particular types of the year, even things like maintaining Facebook pages, which has become obviously a much more recent form of continuing bonds. Someone dies, and instead of shutting down their Facebook page, the family will keep it open and people will post things maybe on birthdays or certain times of the year to remember that person. And then the other form of continuing bonds, which I think probably needs mentioning, is when someone has a sense of the presence of the person who's died at particular points. And that is a really, really common experience in grief. Some people think maybe up to about 50% of people have this experience in grief. And it might be that the person seems to see the person or hear the person or even smell the person. That's common. Mm. Or it might not be through a sensory modality. It might just be a sort of general sense that they are there with you. But what seems to be really, really important is a sense of relatedness to the person and the person being there. And again, of course, people might not talk about it. They might be embarrassed by it. Or they might think, well, if I tell my friends, they'll think I'm going mad or whatever. But psychiatrists tend to regard it as quite a normal, and psychologists tend to regard it as quite a normal part of grief. It seems clergy as well, if people go to their clergy about it, they're just told, oh, this kind of thing happens all the time. It's nothing to worry about. So sensing the presence of the dead is a particular kind of continuing bonds, one experience among others, if you like.
It's so interesting just listening to you and thinking about where this theory is emerging from in terms of disciplines. So is it fair to say, I can hear that there's obviously a lot of this work is being done in through therapy and psychology. You yourselves are working in theology, philosophy, religious studies. Get a strong sense of the presence of cultural studies in what you're doing as well, or in continuing bonds theory.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Really, the first continuing bonds theorists and a lot of the people who continue to be major figures in it are from kind of psychology backgrounds, counselling backgrounds, grief theory backgrounds. Dennis Klass was one of the early pioneers, and Edith Stefan is a psychologist doing pioneering work on this today. And often, of course, they'll do the empirical work on this kind of thing, and they're really at the forefront of it. But then philosophers and theologians and others, I think, are slowly starting to become interested. Certainly it's got some interest among a branch of philosophy called phenomenology. So what are sense of the presence of the dead experiences actually like? What is being described here? Mm. Someone like Matthew Ratcliffe would be very interested in that kind of question. And I think probably other philosophers and theologians have been a little bit slower to become interested in it, but we're interested in it. and I think there's scope for kind of people to be interested in it in different ways, in different aspects of it. I suppose one thing that tends to happen when you talk to more kind of analytic philosophers is that the question becomes perhaps overly focused on, are the dead people who are being sensed real, objectively real or not? Do they actually exist or not? What is their ontological status? And that almost becomes then the only question that people want to engage with. Whereas there are other interesting things about it that philosophers and theologians, I'm not saying that question's a bad one, but it's a difficult one. So in the absence of being able to answer that, there might be other things that people can talk about and people can say about it.
I mean, there are obviously so many really important ramifications of this in all sorts of ways. But I suppose we were really interested in today in talking about how it relates to Dante. One way of thinking about Dante's work is to see that there is a really constant preoccupation with the relationship between the living and the dead, the way in which Dante himself responds to the death of Beatrice, you know, could be seen as, you know, a driving theme across the Vita Nova. Obviously, the comedy presents multiple encounters with the dead, and in particular, I suppose, the idea of purgatory that Dante develops. A really important part of that is the idea that the souls in purgatory form a community with the living. The living are actively engaged in looking after the well-being of those in purgatory. And in Dante's view of purgatory, the dead are also praying for the living. So the idea of continuing bonds obviously has a really important part to play in Dante's work. And it's so interesting to hear about these contemporary debates and to think about Dante kind of situating him within that. We got talking initially a few months ago about Dante and continuing bonds theory because of the work that you were doing relating to C.S. Lewis and his work A Grief Observed, where C.S. Lewis makes some really telling references to Dante's Beatrice.
Would you tell us a bit about C.S. Lewis's work, A Grief Observed, and how this relates to continuing bonds?
Many people will know of C.S. Lewis through things like the Narnia Chronicles. So famous writer, famous Christian writer in particular, Christian apologist. A Grief Observed is a diary he kept during his bereavement, just after his wife had died. And originally he published it pseudonymously, but because his writing style is so distinct and he was famous and everyone knew that his wife had just died, it didn't take people very long to work out who it was by. It's often read therapeutically, so it's often read by people also undergoing grief and bereavement. I've got a friend who's a counsellor and she recommends it as the best thing that she's read on grief to her patients. So it's really, really helpful, or a lot of people find it very helpful in the context of grief. It is called A Grief Observed, so one thing that people emphasise is it's only one experience of grief. It's not typical of everyone's, but a lot of people find that the experiences resonate with them. And during the course of A Grief Observed, his relationship with God and his relationship with his wife, whom he calls H, he just knows her in this text as H, change in ways that, perhaps mirror is the wrong word, but in ways that relate to one another, the way that the relationship between him and God and him and H change, kind of relate to each other in different ways. He starts off really by questioning his faith. He has a strong sense of God's absence, God's silence, and at the same time needing reassurance of H's continued existence. And he talks about Christian conceptions of the afterlife being really unhelpful to him. So a lot of people kind of apparently said to him at the time, you've got faith, that must be a great consolation. And he says, that's the last thing it is. It's not helpful to me at all. And that's because he wants to see his wife in all her particularity and to have what he calls the everyday heartbreaking commonplace back. That's what he's grieving for. That's what he's missing. And so the idea that she goes on, but as a kind of super cosmic eternal something, doesn't give him what he wants at all. And at that point, he says that he regards all of that stuff about family reunions on the furthest shore as unscriptural and all out of bad hymns and lithographs. So he sort of dismisses the idea that he's going to meet her and be with her again in all her particularity and all that sort of earthly everydayness ever again. And that's the thing he really misses. And he says, my faith is in no way a consolation in grief. And at this time, he also has a really acute, I think quite distinctive worry that his memory of her is fading, so that when he calls her to mind, he's not actually remembering her anymore, but really only remembering a construction of her. So if you like, that he might lose her twice, by losing her in the sense of her dying and then also losing the memory of her as she really was, kind of creating an idealized image of her instead. That's kind of towards the first half of the book. It's actually a tiny book. It would probably take you less long to read it than me going on about it. There's so much in it. And then there's a shift, and he has this sense of peace. He says God is sort of often still silent, but the door to God is no longer shut and bolted, so that the silence is a sort of compassionate silence, not an absence of God. And he experiences a sense of her presence. So he says, she seems to meet me everywhere, though he then qualifies it and says, meeting is too strong a word, and describes what happens instead as something like impressions. So we get a real sense of that kind of sense of the presence of the dead type experience, although we never really find out whether it's a specific one through a kind of sensory modality, or whether he just feels that she's there in some sense. It's very, very commonplace and very everyday. So he says it's not a rapturous reunion of lovers, but more like getting a telephone call about some practical arrangement. So the sense of that everydayness that he'd really missed comes back to him through these impressions. And interestingly, he begins to talk about their marriage as continuing after death. And says that perhaps the pains of separation from people you love is actually part of the purgatorial suffering, in which case separation at death is a phase of marriage, not its truncation. So he's got this strong belief in purgatory. Kind of interesting, because he was brought up Church of Ireland and then was an Anglican, but he's got this very strong belief in purgatory. And also this fear of misremembering becomes less acute. So he makes an analogy to the Eucharist, and he says, well, at the Eucharist I receive Jesus, but it doesn't look anything like Jesus. It looks like a waiter. And he says, likewise, a really good photo might become a snare or an obstacle to him. So what he wants is the real Jesus, not the image of Jesus. And likewise, what he wants is union with the real age, not a sort of faded fake memory of her. But he feels he can have this without having this kind of strong image of her. It no longer worries him that his memory of what she looks like and so on is fading. And then, you know, he had this sort of problem with the eschatology, the view of the afterlife, of being reunited with the further shore earlier on. But he says he no longer thinks that that doesn't happen. He no longer thinks that that's a problem, that people are reunited in all their particularity. He thinks that can happen. Rather, what he regards the problem as being is when God is treated as a means to an end, the end of seeing the person that you loved again, and not as an end in God's self. But as long as God is kind of treated as an end in God's self, then there's no reason why you wouldn't be reunited with the person you love. And then right at the end, he ends with a quotation in Italian, which I'm not going to try and pronounce, from the Paradiso. And this is the very last line of this book. And in English, it's something like, and then she returned to the eternal source, or then she returned to the eternal fountain. And I hadn't read Dante, and I sort of read this and tried Google translating it and found out where it was from, probably shocking lots of listeners to this. But this, of course, is Beatrice, whom he loved and who died, who guides him through paradise, and she's returning to God, and he's returning to live his life on earth. He's someone whose thought is imbued with classical literature and classical references, and medieval literature and references in particular. And it didn't seem like the sort of thing he would just choose by accident because it sounded nice and stick it in there without thinking about how that related to Dante and certain types of theology more generally. So really we wanted to have a look at how his inclusion of that passage in particular should influence our reading of A Grief Observed more generally. So what he might be saying theologically by including that, and even how we should read earlier parts of the diary in light of that.
So I think anyone listening to that who knows Dante will be probably like me, kind of finding all sorts of resonances with Dante's work. Whether it's that idea of C.S. Lewis identifying the dangers of misremembering and kind of constructing a false image of the person who's lost, where I think that's an idea that Dante works through in a number of places. But I think it's very telling that when he's going through hell, the souls there are very preoccupied with constructing a sort of fixed, flattering image of themselves so that they can kind of live on. So they want to have a continuing presence on earth, but it's one that they're constructing through their own fame. And I think that's something that Dante really sees as quite problematic. But also when he finally does meet Beatrice in the earthly paradise, one of the lovely things about that moment is that Beatrice is clearly not behaving the way Dante expected, and that the Beatrice that he does meet is actually quite combative, and Dante, you know, Dante's kind of broken down by that, as though he's sort of saying, well, you know, I had this idea that I'd formed, and actually that was completely wrong.
That's so interesting. That's very similar to what C.S. Lewis finds, that he sort of, when he's thinking of H's image, he's beginning to suspect it's an idealized perception of her. And then when he talks about her, it's often, and particularly these sort of impressions of her, it's her argumentativeness and her quickness he really picks out. And it sounds like she'd often sort of tell him when he was talking nonsense and that kind of thing. And
right.
That kind of thing that he kind of is really, really struck by, and that makes him think it's meeting her or an impression of her and not this sort of built up image, idealized image.
Oh, that's brilliant, because that's exactly Beatrice in the comedy, who is just correcting Dante all the time, explaining stuff. And the really interesting thing, I think, from that is that until that point, when Dante's written about Beatrice in the Vita Nuova, she's clearly kind of idealized and she brings Lessing into his life and so on, but she's silent, basically. So that move, I think, that Dante kind of works out as he moves from the Vita Nuova into the writing the comedy, where the kind of the reality of the encounter means that, well, she has to talk back and she has to be a bit unexpected, seems really, really valuable there. And then one of the other things that really resonated was you talked about the everydayness. So C.S. Lewis is talking about grieving. I can't remember the exact phrase that you had, which was very beautiful. Oh, the heartbreaking commonplace. Mm. And so the everydayness of the, you know, what's missed, but also in what comes to feel like a sort of a genuine encounter with H. And I think that's, you know, Dante's working with everydayness as well in all sorts of ways, but perhaps most especially with the language he uses across the comedy, which is full of everyday language alongside quite elevated philosophical, theological, lyrical, even epic language. You get this kind of earthy, ordinary language, which he clearly sees as important. And there's an everydayness to the encounters as he meets, you know, bumps into people that he knows as he's moving through Inferno and Purgatorio as well. So interesting that you were talking earlier when you were introducing continuing Bond's theory, and you were talking about things like, you know, smell as actually being important there. So the encounter is very ordinary, and that's what makes it important. And Dante, I'm sure, you know, there's something really rich going on here, obviously in terms of Dante himself, but also perhaps in terms of what C.S. Lewis is finding in Dante.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And you get this a lot in different sensing of the presence of the dead account. So when people have this sense, you know, whether or not this is the kind of thing Lewis is describing or not. Mm. So someone might just see their husband say, "Good night, love," or "Have you checked the doors?" And it's so unlike a ghost to them or anything extraordinary. It's a very, very everyday experience. But then they'll often reflect, "But I know if I told people about this, they might think I'm going crazy or they might worry about me," or something like that. So and definitely that sense of smell. They're just there and somehow you can smell them, or it's very earthy.
And then obviously that final reference to Beatrice, you know, there's so much in there, clearly in terms of a grief observed, but also in terms of, I suppose, how Dante is thinking about that relationship between the particular person and God, and how that affects his sense of the relationship, the bond with that person. And that's also a debate which, it's a set of questions which is quite live in the Christian tradition as well.
That's right. Well, let's talk about Aquinas first of all. Just thinking back to the passage from Dante, she's returning to the eternal fountain, but she's not thereby separating herself from Dante. Quite the opposite. In uniting herself to God in the beatific vision, the vision of God's glory, she's more united to Dante than she could possibly be otherwise. And Aquinas is a great lens to view this kind of theology of the afterlife through. It's a pretty standard theme in Aquinas that there's not a competition between God and things that aren't God, creatures, or that there needn't be a competition, that creaturely reality, when it's flourishing properly, is in union with God and is in no way a competitor with God. And you see this particularly in the theology of the afterlife. So we are destined, thinks Thomas, for the beatific vision, the vision of God's glory, where we see God as God is. But in seeing God as God is, I'm united to God. I know other things as united to God. So in particular, I know other human beings in fellowship with them through being united to God. So contrary to C.S. Lewis's worry about bad hymns and lithographs, Thomas sees this kind of communion of the saints, as he might put it, as being absolutely central to the Christian hope. And it's not a choice between either being united to God or being united to other people. If I love and value those people appropriately and I seek after union with God, then I have both, as it were. It's both and rather than either or. And that, I think, comes through in the position Lewis ends up in. He starts off being very either or. So Lewis starts off for a position where to hope properly for his wife's eternal destiny is to want something for her that is completely separate from him. And that's a cause of considerable grief to him. Effectively, you've got permanent loss. You certainly don't have what people hoped for in those bad hymns and lithographs. But he comes through his experiences, he comes to this position where, through her being united to God, she is also united to him. And that resonates certainly with Thomas, and I think also with Dante, and is really a much more hopeful picture of afterlife destiny than the one he started with.
That's really interesting, Simon. And I think what seems to be happening in both C.S. Lewis and Dante is not so much that they've come up with a theological insight that supersedes or does anything new in relation to what Aquinas has done. But what they're doing is trying to work through some of the difficulty of how you imagined and experienced that reality. You know, the interest is in how they're relating that insight into experience.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, Augustine is also here in the background, yes. I think. Augustine of Hippo, that is, not Augustine of Canterbury. He often kind of gets a bad press, and it's not entirely undeserved that earlier Augustine, just after he's kind of converted to Christianity from Platonism, is still very kind of Platonist, and he sees there as being a real tension between love of neighbour, love of friends and family and so on, and on the one hand, and love of God on the other. And he kind of thinks that our afterlife destination is really all about God. That's where the real importance lies. So our relationships in the here and now are of only relative importance. But he later changes his mind. Perhaps you might say he sort of loses some of the more Platonic elements of his thought a little bit in that respect. And by the time of The City of God and De Trinitate, he really sees there as being no tension between love of God and love of neighbour. And he has a kind of social eschatology. In other words, he thinks that in the afterlife, we get to hang out with the people we loved. So, for example, he says in De Trinitate, he who loves his brother loves God because he loves love itself, which is of God and which is God. So someone who loves their brother or their wife or their husband or whatever loves God. That is part of loving God. And because God is love, God is loving your beloved one through you almost. Mm. And I think as well, it comes back to what Simon said about God not being another person who's in competition with others that we love. So Augustine says, God is closer to me than I am to myself. So it's kind of clear from that God is not this other person who is competing for our affections with the other people in our lives. God is a different kind of thing or not a thing at all. But in being close to God, we don't become less close to those others in our life. And that's really a feature of the later Augustine.
So there are so many interesting questions in my head at the moment as a reader of Dante that I'd love to talk about. We could probably talk for hours, but maybe one thing that we could perhaps end by thinking about is the question of how the issue of the continuing bonds with the dead isn't just an individual question for Dante. So we've been talking, I suppose, in terms of sort of individual bereavement. C.S. Lewis is talking about, you know, his mourning for H as one person. You know, one of the really striking features of Dante's afterlife is just how social it is. In hell, it's clearly a dysfunctional society, but certainly purgatory, you know, you entirely miss the point of purgatory of Dante's purgatory, if you don't see its inherent social nature. Does that also play a part in continuing bonds theory?
I think it certainly should do. I think we inhabit quite an individualistic society in the contemporary West, and that colours how we think about all sorts of things, including grief. So when I think about grief, I may think about my own relationship to a relative who has died. And of course, that's very real, and that's something that needs attention. But we often lose sight of the social aspects of relationship between the living and the dead. How we memorialise the dead, for example, how duties towards the dead might colour our action today. And there's all sorts of things. I mean, there's ecological potential here, I think, thinking about holding the world in trust, those sort of ideas. In a more sinister fashion, if you look at far-right thought, for example, ways of memorialising the war dead feature heavily. Finding ways which are genuine ways of relating to the dead, but which involve flourishing both for ourselves and for the wider ecosystem of which we're a part, I think is quite urgent. And I think one of the things about a text like the Comedy is it allows us to look at these issues through a lens that is other than the lens of our contemporary hyper-individualistic society. And as you say, there's this theology of purgatory and indeed of paradise, which is utterly social. That can perhaps unsettle our own preconceptions, our own ways of seeing things, and make us have a bit of a healthier view of the relationship between the living and the dead, I think.
I would second all of that. Within grief theory, there's quite a lot of stuff about how grieving with others shapes the relationship of grief, and it's a very different thing if you go through grief on your own. I guess that's why we have funerals. And in some ways, you know, there's a worry that there is a loss of communal ways of grieving. The image here is sometimes of someone who two parents who lose a child, and it seems that they're experiencing the same grief in some sense. Their bodies are so attuned to each other, their memories of this child are so attuned to each other, and so on. And so you might talk about something like shared grief, and I think when people have had the experience of grief, it's a very different thing to go through it alone. C.S. Lewis's experience seems to be interestingly lonely, actually. It's really him grieving, but that's not everyone's experience. That's one way in which his experience differs from others. And I think as well, in the, you know, as Simon says, we live in a very individualistic society, and this idea of breaking bonds, of what gets called moving on, you know, you've got to move on all the time, and continuing bonds is kind of the opposite of that. And of course it's focused particularly on the context of grief, but also the sort of continuing bonds, the bonds we have with people generally, with different generations of people, with the world as a whole, with non-human animals, and so on. Yeah, so that sort of sense of, I mean, continuing bonds generally, the things that it emphasises are not having this atomistic view of a person who is moving on as a sort of soul being going through life, having particular attachments at particular times, but divesting themselves of them when they're no longer wanted or whatever, to a much more social conception. Someone we know works on Thomas Aquinas, and this is Mark Wynne. He's interested in the way that relationships that we have with people in heaven kind of inform how we relate to people now, and should really, in Aquinas's thought, sort of mirror. We should always be thinking about what our relationship with them will be like at the eschaton. And so again, it's not this kind of individualistic, atomistic view of humans, where you lose contact with people when they're no longer relevant to your particular goals and projects in life at that particular moment.
Well, Tayta and Simon, it's been an absolutely wonderful conversation. I think we could have gone on for hours, or at least I could have done. And it's been one of those very great conversations about Dante, where you come away feeling like you understand Dante a little bit differently, but also you start to see some of the ways in which the ideas that Dante can encourage us to think about helps us to see the world that we live in differently, and to think about our own lives in new ways. So it's been really very exciting to talk to you. Thank you both very much.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you
for having us.
I found it really interesting talking to Tayta and Simon. I hope you did too, and I hope you're enjoying this series of conversations on Dante. We've got plenty more conversations lined up, so do look out for those. But for now, I'd just like to say thank you very much indeed for listening.